This is the Reason Interview with Nick Gillespie. Thanks for listening. Please subscribe to this podcast at Apple, Google, Spotify, Stitcher, SoundCloud, wherever you get your podcasts, or go to reason.com/podcasts and check out the Reason Roundtable and the Soho Forum debates as well. We live in a world where a Boeing executive was forced to resign over a 33-year-old article opposing women fighting in combat, and a respected art curator was pushed out of the San Francisco Museum of Modern Art for saying that he would definitely still continue to collect white artists. The editor of the New York Times opinion page left his job after publishing an article by conservative Senator Tom Cotton of Arkansas, and the TV host Nick Cannon was fired by Viacom CBS after voicing anti-Semitic comments on his podcast. What is driving such instances of what many call cancel culture? To answer that question, I turn to Jonathan Rauch of the Brookings Institution. He's a contributing writer to The Atlantic and a signatory to the recent open letter in Harper's warning that the free exchange of information and ideas, the lifeblood of a liberal society, is daily becoming more constricted. In 1993, Rauch wrote Kindly Inquisitors, The New Attacks on Free Thought, an influential defense of free speech and open inquiry that was excerpted in Reason. Is free thought under unprecedented attack? And if it is, what's driving the new repression? Rauch, who is currently working on a book tentatively titled The Constitution of Knowledge, answers those questions and discusses the best way to engage censors and cancelers.
John Rauch, thanks for talking to Reason.
Always great to see you, Nick. And of course, I'm a Reason fan. Don't forget to mention, I'm a Reason contributor. Reason ran the first excerpt of Kindly Inquisitors, my book on this. I'm working on a sequel now and expect to have more collaboration with Reason in the future. So thank you very much. Yes, free speech and free thought and free inquiry are under pressure right now. No, it's not unprecedented. Those of us who have been advocates of free inquiry for decades know that it's an unending battle. Every generation, in fact, every day, you got to get up and justify this crazy idea from scratch that, you know, if an idea is outrageous or wrongheaded or insidious or bigoted, that it deserves not just toleration, but protection. That's a nutty idea. It's always seemed nutty and it always will. I signed the Harper's letter because what's happening now, although not particularly worse than all the other stuff that's happened, you know, burning novels like Ulysses, which happened in my grandfather's lifetime, it's different. So here's what's different. We've always had campaigns by activists to deplatform speakers, ideas, thoughts that they don't like. It's par for the course. And now what's a little bit different is a couple things. First of all, you've got an ideology which is pretty intolerant of dissent and feeling its oats right now. Some people call it woke and successor ideology, all kinds of names for it. We can get into it. It's kind of a neo-Marxist ideology in which the sort of oppressed minorities take the place of the proletariat, and cisgender white people kind of take the place of the bourgeoisie, and the revolutionary vanguard is sort of the activists who are doing this deplatforming. So that's the first thing. The second thing that happens is social media, which makes it orders of magnitude easier than it ever has been in the past to organize a campaign targeting an individual, or more important, a secondary boycott, targeting anyone who has anything to do with that individual, with shaming, ostracism, boycotts, and so forth. So that's new. And the third thing is that you've actually got people who've discovered sort of the soft underbelly, which is that if you put pressure on people's employers and professional connections, it's very easy to get individuals shunned and fired. Because, you know, there's lots of alternatives to Nick Gillespie out there in the labor market. So if I can make Nick seem very controversial, yeah, you know, people will figure out, well, maybe I'll just go hire someone who's less controversial than Nick. So when you put those three things together, yeah, you get some pretty significant chilling that can go on.
Can we, in preparing for this, I reread Kindly Inquisitors. I think I interviewed you for the 20th anniversary edition that came out from University of Chicago Press. and Cato, I guess, in 2013. We ran an excerpt of that as well. You've been covering this beat for, basically 30 years. Is there something different? In Kindly Inquisitors, you were talking a lot about Salman Rushdie, who had had a fatwa put against him. I mean, he was under, a death sentence put out by the Ayatollah Khomeini. Is that a more serious threat than what we're facing now, which is, I mentioned in the introduction, a Boeing executive, a communications guy who got pushed out because he had written an article in 1987 saying that women shouldn't be fighting in combat. He was a Navy pilot at the time. Are these, is it so bad now to say, that guy, he can go work somewhere else? Is that at the same level of saying to Salman Rushdie, you cannot hide anywhere on the planet. A billion Muslims are going to come looking for you and kill you.
Well, it's interesting that you mention Rushdie, Nick, because that's the starting point for a chapter on this I'm working on in a book right now. Here's what's different about the Rushdie case. It was, the penalty there was murder. It was not losing your job and being socially isolated and having your friends all denounce you in public and then tell you in private that they wish they could be supportive. It was murder, and murder is worse. That said, I would argue that structurally, the 1989 fatwa against Salman Rushdie was, in fact, the prototype of the modern cancel campaign. We didn't have that vocabulary at the time, right? We called it international terrorism, which it kind of was, and we called it Islamist extremism, which it also was. But if you look at it, what it was actually was an action to cut off an individual from society, make anyone, not only that individual, but anyone who had anything to do with him, toxic in order to chill the social environment. So here's what I think canceling is and why it's different from criticism. Because people always say, well, look, if you can't stand the heat, get out of the kitchen. People are criticizing Jonathan Rauch. He doesn't like it, so he calls it canceling. Criticism is expressing an argument or opinion with the idea of rationally influencing public opinion through public persuasion, interpersonal persuasion. It's what I'm doing with you right now. Canceling comes from the universe of propaganda, not critical discourse. And it's about organizing or manipulating a social environment or a media environment with the goal or predictable effect of isolating or deplatforming or intimidating an ideological opponent, right? So it's about kind of shaping the battlefield. It's about making an idea or a person socially radioactive. It is not about criticism. It is not about ideas. The people who went after Rushdie had never read the Satanic Verses and were proud of it. And in a typical cancel campaign, today you'll hear the activists say, well, I didn't read the thing. I don't need to read the thing to know that it's colonialist or racist or whatever. So they're not using physical murder now. They're using a kind of social murder of making it very difficult for someone to have a job, for example, to lose their career, to endanger all their friends. That, of course, is not physical violence. But if you've interviewed people who've been subject to it, and I have, you know that it is emotionally and professionally devastating.
So, this Nick Cannon case came up recently, and I'm not sure how familiar you are with him. I tend to think that John Rauch is not watching The Masked Singer on television on Fox, but maybe you are. Nick Cannon is a TV host and impresario. He had a podcast where he had another refugee from the late 80s, Professor Griff, who had been associated with the rap group Public Enemy, who got bounced in the late 80s from Public Enemy for being anti-Semitic. And Professor Griff traffics in the idea that African-Americans are the real Jews. So he spends a lot of time attacking so-called Jews, which would be people who identify as Jewish. Nick Cannon trafficked in a bunch of that on his podcast, and he got fired by Viacom. He has various properties with them. He's still on with Fox. Is there any benefit to having somebody like Nick Cannon kind of go through a scattershot, vague Nation of Islam, Black Israelites, Protocols of the Elder of Zion? Like, should he be able to just say that without having any repercussions on his career? And if he shouldn't, what's wrong with canceling people and more broadly?
Well, he's a I guess he's a professional journalist of some kind, right? And
a TV show host.
So you and I do our jobs within notions of implicit and explicit boundaries. And if I start writing socialist articles for Reason, I think Reason will stop publishing. That's part of what publishers do. So I don't think in a case like that, we're necessarily talking about canceling. I think we're talking about ordinary editorial discretion. And also, by the way, I think there's a difference between ordinary civil self-editing, the things we don't say because they're, you know, they're rude and nasty, and canceling as well. So what makes canceling difficult, different? I'm working on this book. So unfortunately, you came to me at a time when I'm swarming with thoughts on this.
Yeah.
But I sat down and said, so how do we know if something is canceling versus ordinary criticism? And I came out with a list of six things, kind of the warning signs of canceling, like the cancer warning signs. If you've got two or three of these, it's canceling, not criticism. So are you ready? Do you want these? Am I running away with this interview in a bad way? So number one, is the intent of the campaign punitive? Are you trying to punish the person, take away their job, their livelihood, their friends? Second, is the intent or predictable outcome of the campaign to deplatform someone, to get them out of the position that they hold where they can speak and be heard and out of any other such position? Third, is the tactic being used grandstanding? Is it not talking to the person about their point of view? Is it basically virtue signaling, posturing, denunciations, often sort of ritual in nature? Fourth, is it organized? Is it, in fact, a campaign? Is it a swarm? Do you have people out there saying, as is often the case, we got to get Nick Gillespie off the air. We got to get this asshole fired. We got to get his job. Got to make an example.
You obviously have access to my private emails, but thank you.
So if it's organized, then yeah, it's canceling. It's not criticism. Fifth, a certain sign of canceling, secondary boycotts. Is the campaign making not only the individual targeted, but anyone who has anything to do with the individual target? So they are they going after this guy's, I forget his name, Nick, what's his name?
Nick Cannon.
So are they not only saying, you know, we think what Nick Cannon is saying on the air is inappropriate. Are they going after the company saying they'll boycott him? Are they going after his friends and professional acquaintances? If there's a secondary boycott to inspire fear, so that no one wants to have anything to do with the guy for the fear that they'll be targeted next, that's canceling. And number six, is it indifferent to truth? Well-meaning criticism is often wrong, but if it's wrong, you're supposed to say, oh, gee, I'm sorry, that was wrong. You're supposed to pay attention to the facts. Cancelers don't. They'll pick through someone's record over a period of 20 years and find six items which they can use against them. This is what literally happened to Steven Pinker. Tear them out of context and distort them. And if they're corrected on it, they'll just find six other items. That's not criticism. That's canceling. So these are weapons of propaganda. I think what you described in Nick, what's his name case, does not sound Cannon. Like a propaganda campaign. Maybe it is, but these are the kinds of signals that we ought to be looking for.
Okay. That helps clarify things for me. What do you think then of, you know, attacks on Goya products? If you've been following this, the head of Goya, the Latino-owned or food products company, said some good things about Donald Trump, and now there is a boycott against Goya products. Is that, you know, does that count as canceling in the same way you just mentioned an attack by linguists or to get Steven Pinker, the linguist at Harvard, well-known public intellectual, thrown out of a professional association of linguistic scholars? Are these all the same thing, or are they on a continuum, or are they separate?
All of the above. They're all the same. They're all different. Yeah. They're all in a continuum. But I think the spirit of the Goya campaign is not consistent with the spirit of an open society where people can disagree. I think it's legal, of course, but it's misguided. Yeah. It's already backfiring, as these things almost always do.
Right.
I put it in the same spirit of intolerance as everything else.
So you mentioned the open society, and in Kindly Inquisitors, and in your work more generally, you often cite Karl Popper, who kind of popularized, if he didn't quite coin the term, the open society. Libertarians are fond of saying, and I want you are not a libertarian, you are, I would say, a fellow traveler, and the overlap is pretty significant, in my opinion.
I'll take it. It'll do.
Yeah. The open society, you know, explain why an open society is better than a closed society or only a partly open society. What do you mean when you invoke the idea of an open society?
So an open society is a place that has a lot of intellectual pluralism, a lot of diversity of viewpoints, and which instead of trying to eliminate bias by eliminating biased people or eliminating wrong hypotheses by eliminating the people who hold those hypotheses, it tries to pit bias and prejudice against other biases and prejudice. And it does that by forcing contention and critical argument and forcing people to persuade each other over time. That's really what science is. That's really what journalism is. It's all the professions that are engaged in the reality-based community are ultimately trying to do. Use these tools of critical comparison and discourse to persuade each other of who's right. And by doing that, it takes physical coercion off the table. I mean, you know, one way to prove that Nick Gillespie is wrong would be to shoot him, right? That's the most traditional way to do it. It gets rid of the hypothesis. It does not advance knowledge. So Karl Popper, among others, pointed out that the open society is not only incomparably better at producing knowledge than any other society because it allows us to make errors and not be punished for making errors. It allows us to make errors, in fact, much more quickly. That's the secret of science. You make errors much faster. They also pointed out it's a more peaceful society because you're settling differences of opinion without using coercion to do it. You're marginalizing bad ideas, right? You know, if Nick Gillespie continually says really stupid things, people start ignoring him. They just don't pay attention to him in a properly constructed society. So the death rate and the oppression rate goes down dramatically in the open society. I call it liberal science in my book. It's the third great social regime, liberal social regime, the other two being market economies and democracies.
So what is driving, I mean, you would agree that there is an attempt to restrict speech and thought, really, ultimately, because speech reflects thought. What is the primary force that is driving that? I mean, you mentioned some of the kind of technologies. Social media allows for the coordination of cancel campaigns and things like that. But you, I assume, having written for The Atlantic for a long time, you wrote there when James Bennett was the editor of The Atlantic. He was the op-ed page editor at The New York Times who got pushed out after running an op-ed by Tom Cotton, the conservative Republican senator from Arkansas. The article was about calling out troops to, you know, kind of stem what he assumed was going to be a lot of rioting in cities around the nation. Bennett was forced out after a bunch of New York Times people, particularly Black staffers, said that they felt unsafe as a result of that op-ed being run in the New York Times. You know, where is that coming from, or how does that fit into kind of the way that you think about cancellation versus open debate and whatnot?
The emotional safety argument. Yeah, this is at the core of what's going on. In the book I'm writing, I give it no quarter at all. The emotional safety argument, I argue, is fundamentally illiberal, and there is really nothing about it that can be salvaged. It is just inconsistent with the open society. And the reason for that is it says that the most sensitive pair of ears in the room gets to decide what everyone else gets to hear or what everyone else gets to say. The notion here is that emotional safety or emotional injury is a kind of harm, like physical injury. And because it's a kind of harm, it's a rights violation. Well, the problem is this is a completely subjective standard, and it makes any form of criticism potentially subject to censorship, to cancellation, turns criticism and thus science into a human rights violation. So to put that in practical terms, there's not much journalism that you and I can do, Nick, if violating someone's emotional safety, as claimed by them, not by a reasonable person, but as claimed by them, is a human rights violation. So this is there have been various versions of what's now emotional safety over many years. In 1993, in Kindly Inquisitors, I write about it. I call it the humanitarian challenge or the humanitarian fallacy. The notion that words are like bullets, harmful ideas are like a form of violence. emotional safety is just the newest form of that. And it says, well, they're emotional violence. There's a lot of talk about where it comes from. Jonathan Haidt and Greg Lukianoff will tell you that it has to do with the way we're raising kids over the past generation or so. I would argue that it comes from, actually, of all places, the Equal Employment Opportunity Commission under the George H.W. Bush administration, which created...
Can you explain that? Dig into that.
Yeah, so the EEOC in 1989, 1990 promulgated a notion of a hostile workplace environment as being a civil rights violation. And they defined hostile workplace environment. They intended to define it fairly narrowly. It was supposed to have to be targeted to an individual, and this was conduct which would make you, a reasonable person, feel discriminated against or harassed in the workplace. Well, as these things do, this concept quickly spread. And by the mid-1990s, you had cases, for example, where an employer was brought up under a hostile environment complaint by an atheist employee, because the employer was printing Bible verses on his paychecks. You had a Christian employee bring up a hostile environment complaint because a gay employee had a picture of himself with his partner on his desk. You had an art exhibit in Murfreesboro, Tennessee, where paintings were taken down because a city employee said she had to walk past the paintings, and that created a hostile environment. So things very rapidly started moving out of control. Then colleges adopted. We haven't talked about universities. We probably should. That's the other big arm of cancel culture. Colleges adopted it, and it took the form of, well, you're creating a hostile environment for students if you say oppressive and discriminatory things. And that led to a series of things like formal speech codes, but it also led to this notion, well, a hostile environment is an unsafe environment. And if you have to have a safe environment, then you have to proactively scrub the environment of microaggressions and offensive and bigoted statements and anything else that might cause the environment to become unsafe. Well, that's a doctrine which has, even conceptually, no conceivable limits. And that's where we wound up.
What does it, what's the appeal to people? You use the phrase feeling their oats. I mean, people who are in cancel mode right now, you know, they feel pretty good about themselves because they're able to, claim a lot of victories in terms of getting people bounced from jobs or kind of running the conversation. What is the best appeal to them to say, you know what, this type of behavior has a long history of backfiring? What is the appeal? Because when you say, and obviously I tend to agree with you when you talk about a liberal society being a good one, the idea of intellectual or ideological pluralism, I'm all in, but I agree with you. People who are saying, no, that's a false front for a system that is rigged against trans people, against Black people, against other types of minorities, either racial, ethnic, ideological, sexual, you name it. How do you engage them when they are not interested necessarily in hearing what you have to say?
Well, there are two questions there. One is, how should we think about these people? And the other is, how should we engage with these people? Do you want to do both in that order?
Yes, please. That sounds like a good order.
So what are they doing? What do they think they're doing? This is a subject of dispute and conversation. One view is that these are well-intentioned people who are moral campaigners who want to make the world a better place, and that they're idealistic and that they think they have the right answers. And like all people who think they have the right answers, they want to make the world safe for those right answers. Another view is that these are neo-Marxists who are using essentially the levers of power to intimidate others because they can and because it's what people do when they have power over other people. A third reading is that we're talking about a classic public choice problem where you have an organized minority that can effectively influence, intimidate, or silence a larger majority by picking out specific targets, caring about it more than anybody else. And so what's happening here is kind of like lobbying, right? That's why the rice subsidy still exists, because rice growers really want it and they demand it, and they'll hurt you if you try to get rid of it. Well, factions and places like universities or in the internet can do that as well. And they get something for that, right? They get prestige in their communities. They may get someone silenced or fired. And then there's a fourth answer, which is that it's all of the above. And I think that's the right answer. It's all of the above, and it varies by individual. I don't assume that people were cynical when they come after the curator at the San Francisco Museum of Modern Art. I assume that they're idealistic. On the other hand, it doesn't matter. Motives are not the issue here. The effects are the issue is the social effect of the regime in which these kinds of things are happening. So how do you engage with them? The most, I think, single most common question I get when I talk about free speech and open inquiry on college campuses comes from a student. Usually it'll be a freshman, first year, sometimes a sophomore, who says, "So what do I say, Mr. Rausch, when I try to speak up in a conversation?" This will typically be a white male. And I'm told, "Check your privilege. You can't say that. There, what do I do when I'm disqualified from the conversation because I don't have the minority perspective?" And I used to try to say all kinds of things that they could say, try this, try that. And that wasn't a good answer. So then I began telling them, "Well, you figure it out. You know how to talk to your generation. I don't." That wasn't a good answer. The answer that I finally settled on, though the first two are also partly true, is, you know what? It doesn't matter all that much what you say to them because they're not listening. That's what they're telling you. They're not listening. What matters is that you not shut up. They do not have the power to silence you if you do not allow yourself to be silenced. So insist on your right to continue the conversation, to say what you want to say. Don't slink away. That, I think, is how you change. You don't necessarily persuade those people. But as we found in the gay marriage debate, your real target is that third person on the periphery of the circle of the conversation who is seeing one person act rationally and reasonably and other people acting irrationally and unreasonably. And you're probably winning the heart and mind of that third person. So don't shut up.
You wrote in, and I think this was in the 20th anniversary edition of Kindly Inquisitors, you posed one question that you said was, you know, the nut of it, do gays and Jews benefit from toleration of homophobic or anti-Semitic claptrap? And you answer yes in that. And you also wrote, any hate speech law which might have passed would have targeted gay people in the name of defending children, not protected us. You're talking about an earlier moment in American history. Do you feel like that argument, you know, which is kind of the, you know, the French Revolution terror argument, that any, you know, any guillotine you erect to get rid of your enemies, you're going to end up on the business end of that. Does that work at all in the current moment, or is that not really operative anymore?
By work, do you mean is it persuasive to people under 30?
Yeah, I guess, yeah.
It doesn't seem to be super persuasive to people under 30, but I don't know what is really. So I figure my job is just to try to say what's true, to speak from my own experiences, 30 years in the trenches, fighting for gay equality, same-sex marriage, understanding that the only thing that we had was our voices, the ability to make our arguments and the ability to hold up our opponents and show the kind of people they were, which we would not have been able to do in an environment with stifled speech. So I figure the best I can do is make that case again and again. And you know, who knows what works, Nick? It's so improbable if you think about it, that the freedom of speech in America, the government guarantee has strengthened over the past 250 years, not weakened, despite the fact that I think to this day, if you put up the First Amendment to a public referendum, I think it would probably lose.
Right.
So I just tell people, you know, we don't know what works. Hang in there and just keep making the case, because in the long run, we are doing astonishingly well.
Yeah, could you maybe cogitate a little bit on the irony, or I see it as an irony, and these are not, you know, it's not accidental, but I don't know if I understand the complete kind of juncture of this, but simultaneously, we're living at a moment in my life, and we're about the same age, we're mid-50s, you are happier than I am because you were at the happiness curve about getting happy in your 50s, I'm still waiting on that, but, you know, we live simultaneously in an age where speech is more kind of policed and regulated by soft power, not by laws. But, you know, there's a cultural paroxysm of, you know, trying to stop people from saying certain things. And at the same time, we live in an age where you can more freely express yourself in an infinite number of ways. What is the connection between these two things, do you think? Or is there a necessary connection between
them? Yeah, I think there is. It's a perceptive point. So are you going to groan if I invoke John Stuart Mill? If we go right back to 1850, we could go back earlier to Alexis de Tocqueville, but I'll spare you that. So 1850, Mill writes his masterpiece on liberty, and the chapter that everyone studies in that in college is chapter 2, which makes the case I just made for allowing wrong and hurtful ideas to be expressed for three important reasons, unrefuted to this day. What we all forget about, and what I forgot about until I recently went back to it, was chapter 3 of On Liberty, which is quite different. And in chapter 3, what Mill says is the biggest threat to liberty today is not from the government, it's from conformism. He says genius, enterprise, innovation, all of this come from an atmosphere where eccentricity is allowed and accepted. And he makes the case for diversity of viewpoint and eccentricity and individuality as the core of creativity in society, and says that no matter what the government does, if you have a culture which is open to individuality and expression and differentness, despotism won't take. And on the other hand, if you have a culture which punishes diversity and informs conformity, then it doesn't matter what the government rules are. You're not going to have freedom. So I ignored this chapter most of my career because it seemed frankly eccentric. I mean, where is there less enforced conformity than America in our lifetimes, right? I mean, here I am, openly gay, married to a guy, you know, I'm fantastic.
Who we have seen in the background at several moments.
Yeah. A special guest appearance by my husband, Michael. So I kind of ignored this until recently. It turns out Mill is right, both on campuses and in the broader culture. It's now well documented that this source of the repression of ideas and free discussion is not the government, it's social pressure, it's peer pressure. There's tons of evidence from, I've got in front of me a list of polls on this on college campuses. Students are not primarily worried about speech codes or about professors docking their grades for being conservative. They're worried about other students, about being shunned, harassed, eye-rolling. They don't want to get into that. So students are chilled on campus, and we know that because that's what they're telling us. So we're seeing kind of the same thing on social media, and we've kind of moved into this world where we have a different sort of problem. It's social coercion, not government coercion.
What do you think goes into kind of the decline of the individual or individualism in American culture? And I'm thinking, and feel free to disagree or just ignore this. If you grow up in kind of broadly defined post-war culture meant, you know, you're embedded in the Cold War to begin with. That's kind of like a massive meta-narrative that's going on. But most of the cultural and kind of sociological impetus has to do with the individual versus the group. And this could be, National Review they were worried about protecting the individual from big government, particularly the Soviet Union, but big government domestically. The founders of Dissent magazine, which was also created non-Soviet socialists, in their opening credo, they said that we are trying to defend the individual against big business and against big corporations that kind of move people around as, you know, cogs in a machine. Somebody like Ayn Rand and Jack Kerouac, people like this who have nothing in common, seemingly, were both about the individual against conformity, things like that. A novel like Catch-22, I often bring this up. A friend of mine taught high school in New Jersey for 30 years, and he would teach Catch-22. And by the time he retired, he said the students didn't understand, you know, like, why was the system, how could the system be this mean to Yossari, and the system is there to help us? They didn't care about the individual. There's been a decline, I would argue, you know, kind of symbolically, culturally, sociologically, in the individual. The people who talk now, whether it's the people from the 1619 Project, they don't talk in
in the name of individual rights. They talk in the name of collective identity and group rights. Do you think that that is feeding into this? And if so, where has that switch come from?
Well, you're in deeper waters than I can easily navigate there, Nick. It's a pretty profound question. Can I kind of respond by suggesting a slightly different take on it? I'm a little bit off on my own on this, and here's where Mill and I kind of part ways. So what I see happening is a failure, not so much of individualism per se. It's a failure of institutions. So something that Mill didn't appreciate in 1850, which we know a lot more about today, is that the magic of what I call liberal science, it's been called the marketplace of ideas. It's really a marketplace of persuasion. But it's this grand sort of social network dialogue that surfaces ideas and shoots them down and goes on to test them. You know, the kind of thing that's going on right now around coronavirus vaccine on a massive global scale. The magic that makes that happen is not individuals talking to each other in a peer-to-peer network, which is the model of Twitter. That never works because the social incentives are go out there to display yourself to your friends, not to communicate. The magic of liberal science is in the institutions that force us to channel these conversations in socially productive ways. So that's Reason Magazine, The Atlantic, the Brookings Institution. If you're an academic, you're writing for journals, you're undergoing peer review, you're being credentialed by some kind of scientific organization. If you're a journalist, you submit to ethics codes, you probably work for an organization where you're supposed to tell the truth. All of these things are mediated in ways which allow us to be individuals, but also to understand some rules of engagement to follow each other. Well, in a society where you don't have that, or a community, like, say, Twitter, or like, say, an academic culture where it's student to student and peer to peer, where you don't have that kind of mediation going on, the social fabric turns into kind of Lord of the Flies. Who can gang up on who? Who can make the most noise? Who can attract the most followers? And you begin to display to each other instead of talking to each other. So the way I think about this in my book is that actually, weirdly, the way to help us be more liberated as individuals is to strengthen the institutions that we use to connect each other. Does that sound weird?
Yeah.
Not intuitive.
Right. And the idea that institutions, which in many serious ways bind our behavior, actually allow us to communicate better as individuals or develop kind of these eccentricities that you and Mill talk about in positive terms.
Yeah. It's hard to put that on a bumper sticker. I'm still working on it. But yeah, that's that's the idea.
The book you're working on is called, or the working title is, The Constitution of Knowledge. What is the timeline for that, John? And what will you be able to finish it and see it to print before, printing presses or books are no longer available?
Well, tell me when that will happen. It is. Yeah. I'm hard at work on it under a pretty tight deadline, and the target date for publication from Brookings Press will be May 1st.
Oh, wow. That's great. In going back over your work, and again, it's an honor to be at Reason, that, which excerpted Kindly Inquisitors in 93 before I was here, to have worked with you over the past, 25 or so years at various stages. To go back and look at your work on free speech and kind of liberal science as you talk about it, it's both kind of depressing and enlivening, because it's depressing because everything you're saying, it seems like it's gotten worse or more intense. The instincts to shut down speech that somebody finds disagreeable. On the other hand, you talk about how this is an ongoing, you started with this, this is an ongoing process. It never ends. It never stops. And that's kind of heartening. Are you optimistic that, 5 years from now, we'll be in a better place, or will we just be in kind of the same place? Is there a telos to what you're talking about? Do we get closer to the truth, or more to more of an open society?
How do you judge whether progress is possible, and are you optimistic or pessimistic about, you know, the next 5 years?
We definitely get closer to truth, because science, broadly defined to include what you and I do, journalism, the testing of ideas, is a cumulative process, and it's the human species' great secret to success: the ability to accumulate knowledge and improve knowledge across generations over a period of now hundreds of years. So that's not going away. On the free speech front per se, I'm optimistic. I think we're already seeing pushback against the excesses of cancel culture. I think we saw that in the Harper's letter. We're also seeing it other places. I think people are wising up to the tactic of targeting people's employers and getting them fired. And I think as people wise up to that, they'll develop some immunity and there'll start to be some counter pressures on employers. Why did you fire this person? How can you justify that? How can you destroy this person's life? So I think it's a question of constant social adaptive learning. The enemies of the open society, the adversaries, always find new tactics and new ways to come at it. And there's always a response to that. It develops sooner or later, hopefully sooner. And the important thing to discover is that this is not a fight between one set of people and another set of people. It is also a fight within ourselves. There are ideas that each of us hate, that it's very hard to restrain ourselves from not ganging up on in an illiberal way. So we're also fighting to remember these principles in ourselves. I'm optimistic in the big picture because here we are, right? The idea that wrongheaded and dangerous and heretical and blasphemous ideas should be not only allowed but protected is preposterous. It's ridiculous. No society has ever had that idea until about 250 years ago. It shouldn't work. But here we are, and the reason is because despite its ridiculousness, it has the one great advantage of being the single most successful social principle ever invented. So what I tell people is, you know what? Me and you and your children and your grandchildren and their grandchildren will have to get up every morning and explain all of these principles all over again from scratch. And you know what? We just have to be cheerful about that.
You know what? That's a great note to end on. We'll leave it there. We've been talking with Jonathan Rauch, the author of Kindly Inquisitors and a slew of books since then that are well worth checking out. And John, I'll look forward to talking with you about the Constitution of Knowledge in 11 months or so. Thanks so much.
Thank you, Nick.
This has been The Reason Interview with Nick Gillespie. Please subscribe to this podcast at Apple, Google, Spotify, Stitcher, SoundCloud, wherever you get your podcasts, or go to reason.com/podcasts. Thanks for listening.